This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at the Zen Center of New York City. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of Zen Mountain Monastery and ZCNYC. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about the temple's retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org/ZCNYC. Thanks for listening.
Shanti Deva taught, may I become food and drink during times of famine. May I be a protector for those who are without protectors, a guide for travelers, a boat, a bridge for those who wish to cross over the water. May I be a lamp for those who seek a light, a bed for those who seek rest, and may I be a servant for all beings who desire a servant. Now my life is fruitful. Human existence is now well obtained. Today I've been born into the family of Buddhas. I wanted to today and tomorrow talk about these four methods of guidance of practice of the Bodhisattva. This is a teaching I'll draw from Master Dogen in his Shobo Genzo, but it's a teaching of Mahayana Buddhism. How does a bodhisattva guide themselves, him or herself, and how do we guide others? What kind of example do we set? What are the practices that are necessary to be one who is whose life is fruitful, to use this human life well? You know, in our time, it's like if we have maximum entertainment and pleasure, then our life is going well. But you know, that's not very satisfying after all, and it doesn't allow for so much of what we are, who we are, and what we can do within this lifetime. And Buddhism really does see life as an opportunity, as a precious opportunity that is not easily obtained, human life, and that is fragile, but also is extremely powerful because of our consciousness, because of our ability to learn, that even within strong patterns, we can make choices that go forward within those patterns if they're healthy and helpful, or move in different directions if they're not, that we have that capacity. The animal realm in Buddhism is sort of characterized by the inability to do that. In the animal realm, animals are depicted as just being tethered to their instinct. And so then what do we do with all of that choice potential? So how do we find true satisfaction and contentment? So the Buddha said that the Eightfold Path is the path. And he said that over and over and over and over and over and over again. That we need to see the world through the Four Noble Truths. We need to recognize life is dukkha and all of the implications of that and all of the manifestations of that, because so much of suffering as it's understood in Buddhism exists at a very, very subtle level, levels that we don't recognize in the beginning. So we need to recognize that, and then we need to practice and free ourselves from the desires and the clinging and the grasping that feeds into our suffering, tethers us to it. We need to realize nirvana, cessation, peace, self-nature, suchness, and then practice and follow the path. The moral teachings, meta practices, cultivating compassion, loving kindness are essential in Buddhism, essential. That means we can't do this without our moral life. To think that somehow we can realize wisdom and manifest compassion without a moral ground is not just not true, but is not true. But it's not enough. The precepts, moral understanding and teachings and the metta practices and compassion are not enough. Zazen, walking meditation, eating meditation, working meditation, crying and laughing meditation are essential to develop our mindfulness, to discover that part of our consciousness, that consciousness. Not a part of our consciousness, it is our consciousness. And to strengthen that into concentration makes everything that is possible in this human life possible. But it's not enough. Gaining insight and understanding, realizing, seeing directly, fundamentally transforms our way of seeing the world. But it's not enough. And by not enough, I mean it. None of these practices stands alone. In any aspect of Buddhist practice are all aspects, and yet they need to be practiced in their various forms. Because each of their various forms, in the same way that we can think of our physicality, our emotional life, our intellectual being, our spiritual being, we can think of ourselves in those ways. And yet, of course, we need to understand that they're all integrated into one whole, which is us. But there's an important reason why we turn our attention to emotions. We turn our attention to the physical. We turn our attention to our thoughts. But not enough means that nothing, no one practice, no one teaching stands on its own. In other words, we can't just sit or just do this and expect that the whole of this path is going to be revealed to us. So in this teaching, the four methods of guidance for the Bodhisattva, I'll speak about two of them today and two of them tomorrow. So the first is giving, the practice of giving. And what's really interesting is how pervasive giving is within the teachings and as a practice within Buddhism, all the schools. And so within the precepts, there's being generous, there's not stealing, and there's not being stingy. Right? And the antidote to both of those is generosity. Giving is the first of the six paramitas, dana paramita, to give selflessly. I was talking to somebody recently who said that in their tradition, in their monastic tradition, that monastics, when they first enter, they for 2 years, they just serve. That's all they do. They serve before they're allowed to actually begin doing meditation. And then in that, they're learning to serve, right? To give. So that when they begin sitting, right, they've prepared themselves to enter to that, to take that seat of power, but also to do it in that sense of giving, of generosity, rather than, you know, I'm going to go to Zazen and get what's mine. Dogen says, giving means non-greed. Non-greed means not to covet, and not to covet means not to curry favor. Even if you govern the four continents, even if you're a person of great power, worldly power, you should always convey the authentic path with non-greed. And non-greed is kind of a funny way of saying it, you know. Non-greed. It suggests, in a sense, that if we give up our greed, then we will naturally be of giving nature, which is half true and half not true. It's true because that is our nature. And what inhibits that is our greed. And so if we practice non-greed, which is really releasing ourselves, right, freeing ourselves from those impulses towards greediness, that then what we're releasing is that natural generosity that exists within each one of us, right? Which is inherent to our very being. But it's half not true, because then we can become complacent and think, okay, if I just practice, you know, if I just practice letting go of my greed, then I will automatically be generous, which is not necessarily true. In other words, we need to cultivate. Giving is our nature, but we can't be passive and just expect that if we just do this or this, then everything else will come forward and just manifest. And so there are all of these various teachings and practices about giving, about being generous, which means to not cling to what we don't possess and want from another, right? Which leads to stealing, taking, greediness, but also to not cling to what we do possess and don't want to give away, right? Which is what we call stinginess. And so these different aspects of greed, right? You know, when we cling, when we hold on to something, it gives us, you know, superficially a sense of having, right? So there's a sense that we do get something. And this is really the sort of the juggernaut of samsara, is that it works, kinda, right? And so it works in the sense that if we don't look too carefully, and if we don't notice the repetitiveness of our cycles too closely, then the things that we grasp at do give us what we're looking for in that moment to some degree for a while. But of course, what it does is that's what it gives us, a little bit of what we're looking for a little while, right? Which means we will never be satisfied, and we will have to continually sort of reinvest. And that's, of course, what samsara means. But the challenge of it is that it does actually give us, in the moment, a little bit of what we're looking for, if we don't look too closely. And if we don't want too deeply. So in a sense, Buddhist practice is, you know, samsara is sort of living in a very surface level kind of desire, and then being satisfied with a very surface level reward. And what Buddhism is saying is, if you're going to have desire, desire the whole thing. Desire that the whole of your life be satisfied, not just for a moment. Desire that the whole of your experience of things be full and rich and complete. That the whole of your experience of peacefulness not be fleeting and precarious, but be based in something that is influenced by and in relationship to, but not governed by circumstances. In other words, let your greed be so large that it's no longer just about you. Which means it's not greed. And what that does is it brings us into the experience of expansiveness. You know, think of all of the adjectives that are used in Buddhist teaching. Boundlessness, limitlessness, spaciousness, expansiveness, boundary, no boundaries. Over and over, all of these different ways of pointing at something. And how that's not just Buddhism. You know, think about it in so many different traditions, and not just religious traditions, but psychology or science or in the natural world, this infatuation that we seem to have with vastness, right? To stand under the vaulted sky, to stand at the edge of the ocean, to be in the presence of a sacred mountain. You know, think of these essential places in our world that people go to, that create, give them some sense of limitlessness, right? So that we can stand in that, in experience awe which is wonder and a kind of fear, but it's not the fear of danger, it's the fear of being in the presence of something so large that then what are we? And isn't it interesting that that impulse, that desire appears in human beings in so many, in virtually every culture everywhere? Like there's something within us that we already know that we are already and that we want to affirm, we want to understand more deeply, to live in. And so then we think about, when we think about our karmic entanglements, those have just the opposite effect. They give us what we want, but within that pleasure or satisfaction, whatever it is, the only way we can get it is we have to go into a very, very small space. A very, very small mind, a diminished heart, right? A limited capacity, limited generosity, limited responsiveness, right? I mean, that's what happens if you think about being in a very, you know, strong state of sort of negative emotion or negative thinking, right? What are the possibilities in those states? Not many. Not many, right? The world becomes very small, very confined. So it's exactly the opposite of what of that deep sort of impulse, that yearning that we have for something that is vast. Dogen says, whether it is a teaching or something material, every gift has its value and is worth giving. Even if the gift is not your own, that is, it doesn't belong to anybody, like Dharma or flower. There's no reason to keep from giving. The question is not whether the gift is valuable, but whether there's true merit in giving, whether it's a benefit. And so some gifts we know are more, well, in Buddhism, there are three basic forms of giving. There's giving of a material nature, because that's a language everybody understands. When we were doing our holiday dinner at the monastery last weekend, before we started, I spoke to the Sangha a little bit, and particularly to the kids, to the children that were there. And I said, you know, giving, I said, you know, when I say I love you, that means something. But you have to understand the English language to understand it, right? Because there are different ways of saying that in every different language. When I give you something as a gift, you understand that no matter what language you speak, right? That's a universal language. Everybody understands that. I said, when your parents, to the kids, I said, when your parents make you your meals every day, you may think, well, that's what they're supposed to do. They're my parents, right? You may not even think about it. I said, but they're giving you life. That's their way of saying, I love you, right? In a meal. And so that's why giving is such an important practice in Buddhism, because it's a language that everybody understands, both the giver and the receiver. And material gifts in particular, right? We know that language. And so that's one form of giving. Another form of giving is to give refuge, safety, protection, which we could extend to trust, right? A sense of trust, a sense of recognition, of belonging. It's a very powerful thing to offer. And then the third is to give wisdom, to generously give wisdom, which is Dharma, which is every time we give beginning instruction, that's giving wisdom, right? Every time there's a teaching, that's giving wisdom. Every time we create an opportunity for people to practice, right? Those efforts to do that are giving wisdom. So Dogen says, each gift has its own value and is worth giving. Don't get too hung up on the value of the gift. So obviously, some gifts, you know, are worth a lot by those ordinary standards. But there are many stories in Buddhism of people giving very gifts that had no value in and of themselves. Their value was in that they were being given. that the act of giving is itself one complete action, in that there's no before or after, and that the power of giving is not in the thing itself. That's kind of a vehicle, a conveyance. What is powerful is the giving itself. And giving may or may not be recognized, appreciated, rewarded. True giving in Buddhism, Dhanaparamita, is not giving for that reason. It's just giving. But whatever the response is, the giving itself can't be stopped. Even if you give something to somebody and they give it back, that doesn't negate the giving. Right? Giving is complete unto itself. That's how powerful it is. And so when we think about, you know, why do we make offerings to the Buddha, offering of incense, offering of flowers and water? Why do we clean the altar? Why does a student come into Dokusan and do a bow? What is that offering? Why does the teacher offer something in return? Dharma. Why do we take care of this place? Why do you take care of your home? All of these are acts of giving. A gassho, a bow, candlelight. What is happening in the act of giving? Why is it so present within Buddhist teaching? Why is it considered not only indispensable, but unseparatable, inseparable from wisdom and compassion? Loving and caring is understood in every language, and in order for me to give, I have to recognize you. I have to care about you. I have to know that I have something to offer. I have to let go in offering whatever I have to give. You know, as I was working on this, I was thinking about sort of the level and the depth of insincerity in our culture. You know, in our sort of, and what does that even mean in our culture? You know, as though it's one thing, as though there's one experience. But in terms of what, you know, is so sort of ubiquitous within media and, you know, the lack of insincerity, from a Buddhist perspective, that's an extremely precarious state to be in. Sincerity is that of the heart. It is that which matters, that which we care about. And to not care, to not have matters be of the heart, means they're coming from somewhere else. Means something, we care about something else matters. That's why a sincere practice, we can say, is one of the most important things. If we truly understand sincerity, then in a sense, everything else is attended to. And so we can focus so much on what is happening or what is not happening, you know, in our world, in our country. From a Buddhist perspective, all of that is important, but all of that is just an expression of what's underlying. What's going on in your mind? What's going on in the minds of those making decisions, acting? The Buddha said, if beings knew, as I know, the results, the power of giving and sharing, they would not eat without having given first, nor would they stain the stain of miserliness overcome their minds. They wouldn't allow themselves to become overcome by miserliness. Even if it were their last bite, their last mouthful, they would not eat without having shared if there were someone to receive their gift. But because beings don't know, as I know, the power and the karmic shift that results from giving and sharing. They eat without having given. The stain of miserliness overcomes their minds. I find that most powerful. If beings knew as I knew. So he's speaking from a place where he sees things. He sees things we don't see. He sees things I don't see. Right? And he's speaking that from life. So he's calling from that place and saying, if you saw what I see, if you knew what I knew, right? Which is, to me, is like an invitation. It's not like, you know, I'm a jerk because I don't see what he sees. It's a call. Like it's calling us in. That there is a larger view. There are views that we don't see yet. There are things that we are not aware of yet. They're there. In a sense, that's what all truth tellers, all wisdom carriers are doing, is calling to us from that place. And so think of Oryoki, right, which we'll do in just a little bit. Oryoki, think of, if you really pay attention, that's exactly what Oryoki is. Before we take a bite, everyone is fed. Before we nourish ourselves, we turn our attention and our mind to everyone in, you know, sort of in stages or circles. They keep expanding and expanding until everyone's included. And that food itself is for very particular purposes to be a benefit in this world. It's really doing exactly, it's responding to exactly what the Buddha is saying. Before we take a bite, we should share that food. And so one way to do that with every meal is in your mind. That's what the meal gatha is. May I become food and drink during times of famine. May my whole body, my life itself, be food and drink. Then Dogen says, quoting the Buddha, says, when a person who practices giving goes into a community, an assembly, a gathering, people notice. Know that the mind of such a person communicates subtly with others. This is so important. Right? Because again, we can get so just focused on the gift itself. But there is a mind of giving. Just like when we are not generous, there's a mind that is not generous. When we're angry or hateful, there's a mind that is hateful. The Buddha said that actually is much, much more important than the act itself, because that has precedent, right? It didn't just appear in this moment, and it lives on. And it is fueled by that action. And it bleeds into everything else. We can't contain it. And so to recognize the power of just having a mind, an attitude, a heart, just a way of being that is generous, right? That is caring, that is concerned, and that is giving. And so people take notice. The point is not that we become noticed. The point is that generosity is being given, not just in the action, but the generosity itself, the attitude, the mind of generosity is also being given. And being noticed means other people are being affected by it. They're picking up on something, and that encourages them, right? Giving, when we experience somebody who is giving, particularly when it's in difficult circumstances, they become an example to us. Right? It's like they are calling to us. And it speaks of the power of intention, the power of mind. And that's why even to give something very simple, right? Something non-material, just contact, a moment of contact, a smile, an expression of concern, is noticed. Then Dogen says, even if you give to yourself, there is still merit. And how much more so when you give to your parents, your family, children, strangers? That's what I mentioned to the kids in Donna Dinner, and big kids too, all of us. is that, you know, when we give to somebody we love, we care about, right? That has impact, right? And it's happening within that relationship, which is already formed, right? So it's not that we necessarily are expecting the gift, but it's not necessarily such a surprise. When we give to somebody we don't know, right, which is still happening within a container of relationship, but it's a different kind of container, that can have even more power, right? Because it's not expected. And so Dogen here says something very interesting. Even when you give to yourself, that has merit, right? When you give to yourself, someone takes notice. The mind is changed. And so to be generous with ourselves, right? Which we might think, well, wait a minute, isn't that being greedy? Not if we're giving to ourselves, right? When we're greedy with ourselves, we're taking. We're not giving. When we're giving to ourselves, that what does that basically mean? It means giving in a way that is actually helping us to be generous, helping us to be more trusting, helping us to be more in relation. In other words, we're giving in a way that is actually true, that is actually in accord with our vows, with practice, with Dharma. It's very important. You know, the Buddha said over and over, the one you care about most is you. He wasn't afraid to say that, right? We're afraid to say that. No, I care about you more than me. And he was like, no, not really. Not if you're honest. Be honest. We care about ourselves the most, right? He said, that's as it should be, right? But how do we care about ourselves? Is it actually caring for ourselves? Is that caring for ourselves actually helping us? And so I think it's really important, you know, particularly within the Bodhisattva vow, which is so, tends to so emphasize, you know, others, putting others first. But that's because there's the presumption, there's the understanding, you are already taking care of yourself. Everybody does that. But now do that in a way that's more and more true giving, true caring. And the second method of guidance for the Bodhisattva is kind speech. Dogen says, this means that when you see sentient beings, you arouse the heart of compassion and offer words of loving care. It's contrary to cruel or violent speech. So here again, how many ways and in how many teachings is speech, how we communicate with each other through words, is that emphasized? Huge. It's huge. How much care is given to how the teachings are communicated? How carefully that is to be done. Huge. You know, when we're working on liturgy or we're working on a dedication or something, that's given a lot of attention, right? Not just so that it flows well and has aesthetically pleasing, is poetic, although those things are important, because that's part of the message. That's part of how it's received. But what is said is extremely important because it has power. It's like learning, again, how much power we actually have and are wielding so that we use our speech in a way that is moving towards liberation. So kind speech, which is speech that is not false, right? Not deceptive. It is not harsh, right? It's not cruel or violent. It's not divisive. It's not being used specifically for the purpose of separating, creating divisions, boundaries, high and low. And it's also not numbing speech. The Buddha spoke about gossip or idle chatter, which is a very interesting thing. You know, among all these very sort of potent, powerful teachings, it's like, gossip? You know, that seems so trivial. And so it's like, but if we really examine that, what does that actually mean? What is he talking about? Right? So he might say that if people understood what happens within a kind of gossiping mind as I understood it, they would be much more careful. And so I think one way I think of it is numbing speech, speech that just sort of deadens and numbs, anesthetizes, creates indifference, apathy. And so all of this speech that's going out between each other, that's going in to ourselves. So what does kind speech mean? Well, Dogen helps us here. He says, in the ordinary world, there's the custom of asking after someone's health. In the Buddha way, there's the phrase, please, take care of yourself. And the respectful address to our elders, may I ask how you are? It's not complicated language. It's kind speech to speak to sentient beings as you would to a baby, which means with that kind of care, that kind of attention, gentleness. And of course, with all bodhisattva practices, with everything we call practice, what makes it practice and powerful is your mind. So we can say those ordinary things and be numb, be absent-minded, right? Not really mean it at a basic level. And so even though the words have a certain kind of power, they're diminished because we're not, our heart's not in it. It's not sincere. In the same way that we can, in our liturgy, in our expression of our vows that we do every day, if when you bring together heart, mind, words, action, it's at its most powerful, its potential to change you, to transform your mind, is at its most powerful. So naturally, if we're really, if we mean this, that thing we're doing, then we want to do it in such a way that has the most effect, right? And so that means that's why it's so important to do it with mindfulness, to do it with your whole being. You can do that in Zazen when you're being particularly self-critical. And just bring to mind, be patient. Be patient. Or in a moment of fear, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Or trust yourself. To bring those words to mind is to manifest kind speech. Dogen says, praise those with virtue and be kind to those without it. And while this is very important and very true, for Buddhists this can be a trap. Because when we're in the presence of someone who is causing harm, right? Being kind doesn't mean just being nice. Sometimes being kind to that person means stop them. That's how we manifest kindness. Because the longer they are manifesting that harm, they are clearly hurting everybody else. They're also hurting themselves. The longer we stay in an unhealthy relationship, we are not being kind. We might stay in it because we think if I leave it, this person's going to suffer. They're going to be in a lot of pain. They're already in a lot of pain. And so to continue it is to continue, in a sense, to be unkind by allowing that unhealthy, hurtful relationship to continue as it is. Dogen says, if kind speech is offered, little by little, it gets larger. It gets easier. Thus, even kindly speech that goes unrecognized or unnoticed still manifests itself right here. And while our present life persists, we should become fond of speaking kindly. Appreciate the value of speaking kindly. That when we speak kindly, something has to happen within us for that to happen. There has to be kindness. And that's why there are practices, you know, like the four measurables, that in a moment where you're not feeling kind, right, you're not feeling generous, to bring forth words that speak of kindness or speak of generosity. it can be such a powerful practice because you're drawing upon that which does exist within you in a moment where you're not, when you feel overwhelmed by something very different. And what makes it authentic and not a pretense or contrivance is that you know what you're doing. You know what you're doing. You're not trying to pretend that you're angry or you're feeling hatred. You know that you are. You're owning that. And maybe that's why, because you're acknowledging that, but you don't want to just hang out there, right? And so you draw upon that which is in you, even though it may feel far away, right? Which is that kindness or that generosity. And in doing that, something has to shift. There has to be a kind of internal rearrangement for that to happen. That's a very powerful moment because you're holding all of it. Right, we tend to think, well, once I get rid of the anger, then I'll be kind. Since kind speech is the foundation for transforming those with anger and hostility. Those who hear kind speech will be deeply touched. They will always remember it. And what's interesting about this is in that moment, it may be as though they didn't hear. We've all had such moments. But the ears hear, right? And mind consciousness hears. On the surface, there may not be a response, there may even be a rejection, but they have heard. And how I understand, they will always remember it, is that now you have planted a seed, you have created something, right, that has a life. How that seed comes to life depends on many things, but it has a possibility. Dogen says, know that kind speech arises from a kind heart and a kind heart from the seed of compassion. Ponder the fact that kind speech is not just praising the merits of others. It has the power to turn the destiny of a nation. It's not just praise. Right? This is very important. Compassion is not always, doesn't always appear nice. Sometimes it's tough. Sometimes it's firm. Sometimes it's no. But that's manifestation of kindness. That's the manifestation of kind speech. And what makes it kind speech is that it's no without hatred in our heart. And that's what makes it such a deeply spiritual practice. We can't do that and not have to encounter everything else. Right? That's like going right into the vault. And saying, if we want to be able to do that in a way that's genuine, first of all, we're not just going to get there. We're going to practice it. And we're going to practice it in innumerable moments. And many of those moments are going to seem very small and insignificant or even pathetic. Right? It's not going to feel very powerful. We won't feel very powerful. It won't feel like compassion. It won't look like compassion. So don't get hung up on what it looks like. Right? But trust how to practice in those moments. That's how we turn the power of this nation. Dogen says, what is truly difficult to turn around is the heart and mind of sentient beings. That's the most difficult thing. When you make one offering, you begin to turn the mind. After which we hope to keep turning until the way is realized. And that's why, you know, practicing in this moment and at the same time holding that this is a long path, this is life. So we don't get hung up on the results of this moment and be just, you know, obsessively looking for that. Is it working? Is it working? Is it working? What we need to know is basically how to practice. That's what we need to know. Right? And we learn that by doing it, by doing face-to-face, by studying the Dharma. And then if you trust that you have a basic good sense of how to practice, that's how a nation is turned. That's how you transform your life. in this moment, right? To the measure of this moment. It may be small, it may be large, but most certainly, and certainly over the arc of your life. Both of those are essential. And it's also important to keep both of those in view, right? So that when you're struggling when we're struggling in this moment, you can have that larger view and say, am I doing what I can do? Yes, I'm doing what I can do. Okay, so relax, right? Just do what you can do. Practice what you can practice to the best of your ability and trust that the mind is turning. Okay.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.